Old Joshua was a frequent visitor to the court in Columbus County. Frequent, that is, as a defendant, as Joshua was one of the most prodigious manufacturers of private stock gentlemen's lubricants, made without governmental oversight. That is to say, moonshine whiskey. It had been a particularly difficult day in court, and Judge Raymond Mallard was seeking a little relaxation, and saw Joshua passing by. The judge called out to him, "Joshua, do you think there is any chance that you may be related to the Joshua of the Old Testament that made the sun stand still?" Joshua was quick to reply,
"No, sir, I'm the Joshua that made the moon shine."
This is Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Farah Tolson, and this program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin. And would you believe that story really happened?
And how do you know that story is true?
Would Kurt lie to you?
That story did indeed happen. And did you know that Judge Raymond Mallard went on to become the chief judge of the North Carolina Court of Appeals?
And that story is just one of many that actually took place in North Carolina.
So today, we are going to look at our court system and some of the humorous things that have happened there.
With a lot of these stories coming from right here in North Carolina.
And for many of these local stories, we can thank a book entitled Disorder in the Court, written by two men from Silva and Jackson County, Bob Terrell and Marcellus Buchanan.
Are they lawyers?
Marcellus Buchanan is better known in North Carolina by his nickname, Buck. He got his legal education at UNC Chapel Hill, served in the state legislature representing Jackson County for three terms, and then went on to become the Superior Court Solicitor for the 30th Judicial District.
And Bob Terrell went to Western Carolina University and then joined the staff of the Asheville Citizen Times. He's been a sports writer, sports editor, news editor, and columnist.
A journalist and a lawyer, and all their stories are true?
Shame on you, Bob. They are both from North Carolina.
Ooh, sorry. That does make a difference. Okay, tell me another one.
All right. Some time ago, Asheville attorney Joe Reynolds was defending a man in Superior Court in Buncombe County. He was accused of stabbing a cab driver with a pocket knife. It was revealed that the accused had been down on North Lexington Avenue carrying on.
I remember this story. He said, "Your Honor, I was chasing women and trying to drink the town dry."
And how many bars?
Every one I could find. Must have been 8 or 10 of them.
And at the end of the night, you call for a taxi cab to take you home?
That I did.
And the driver knew you?
Had taken me home lots of times. Knew right where I lived.
So why did you stab him?
I told him to stop.
And?
He didn't stop.
You stabbed him because he didn't stop.
That's right.
Why?
Because I told him to.
Wait a minute.
Yes, Your Honor?
I just want to get this straight. You said that you are 68 years old.
That I am.
And you spent the day on Lexington Avenue chasing women and drinking liquor?
Well, to be correct, Your Honor, all day and half the night.
All right, before we go any further, I'm calling a recess for an hour. And you, I want to see in my chambers.
What for, Your Honor?
We are about the same age, and I want you to tell me your secret.
Also, out in Buncombe County, a black man named Ken McDaniels was an assistant district attorney. He was trying a case against a fellow accused of driving while intoxicated. One of the pieces of evidence against him was the arresting officer noted that he had a red face at the time, indicating that he had been drinking. The defense attorney tried this tactic.
Your Honor, the prosecution claims that a red face is evidence that my client had been drinking. Well, my client happened to have been wearing a red shirt at the time of his arrest, and his face was simply reflecting the color of the shirt. That's why his face is red.
When it came time for Mr. McDaniels to proceed, he said simply, "Your Honor, I have been wearing a white shirt today. Has my face turned white?"
In 1968, during a criminal proceeding in Superior Court in Monroe, Judge John D. McConnell had summoned the bailiff to the bench for a short consultation. Meanwhile, an inmate had found a courtroom lockup door that had been left unsecured, so he opened the door, sped across the courtroom, jumped the rail, and went out a back door. Union County Deputy Curtell L. Rollins was serving as a bailiff at the time and promptly gave chase. As the escapee neared a door which would admit him to a stairwell and ultimately freedom, a court official came to the door. Seeing the fleeing man, he politely held the door open and the man raced through. After a chase through the courthouse, the escapee was recaptured and returned to lockup. When the interrupted court session was resumed, the court official was brought before the judge and was asked why he had held the door open for the fleeing man. The official apologized and said, "I'm sorry. I didn't realize he was an inmate. He acted like a lawyer from Charlotte."
We know that there is a lot of pressure on an attorney. Not only does he have to win his case, to do so, he must make a good impression on the jury and on the judge.
And in the midst of the legal battle, sometimes the mouth goes before the brain engages. Here are some examples from North Carolina courtrooms.
"Did you keep that in your possession the whole time that you had it?"
Referring to this photograph, "Were you there when the picture was taken?"
"How long have you practiced surgery as a surgeon?"
"The 24th of December, you say? Was that the day before Christmas?"
One young attorney making his first court presentation certainly won a lot of style points with the following statement. He had been retained by a farmer who was suing a railroad company for killing 24 of his hogs, and the barrister wanted to duly impress the jury with the significance of this loss.
24 hogs, ladies and gentlemen. 24 hogs. Twice the number there are in the jury box."
Now, any good comic has a second banana to make him look better. So many an able attorney had a witness to help him look more legal.
Do you know how he was when he was alone?
"No, Your Honor. I was never with him when he was alone."
"You say he was cruel to you. How did he do it to you?"
"He hit me and bit me."
"And what did he hit you with?"
"His fist."
"And what did he bite you with?"
"What was he painting the inside of the drum with?"
"Paint."
"Do you think that this is a permanent condition?"
"Well, it's temporarily permanent."
"What would cause the pressure to be greater on one side than the other?"
"Increased pressure on that side."
"Were you acquainted with the decedent?"
"Yes, sir."
"Before or after he died?"
"Do you recall approximately the time that you examined the body of Mr. Smith?"
"It was in the evening. The autopsy started at about 8:30 p.m.
"And Mr. Smith was dead at the time. Is that correct?"
"No. He was sitting on the table wondering why I was doing an autopsy."
"Now, you are here as a witness against the defendant who is accused of biting off the plaintiff's ear."
"Yes, sir."
"And did you actually see the defendant bite off the man's ear?"
"Well, no, I didn't."
"You did not see the event?"
"No. Not actually, no."
"Then, how do you know that he really bit off the man's ear?"
"Well, I just seen him spit it out."
"You are here today on a charge of making bootleg liquor. How do you plead?"
"I don't know, Your Honor. I ain't heard the evidence yet."
"Now, making moonshine was a regular occurrence in parts of North Carolina, and so it was not unusual for the manufacturers of said product to be frequent visitors to the courtroom. Old Sam thus appeared one day before a federal judge and was recognized immediately."
"Sam, how many times have you come before me for making illegal liquor?"
"Well, I don't rightly recollect, Your Honor."
"Have you made liquor all your life?"
"Reckon so, Your Honor."
"And how much liquor do you think you've made, Sam?"
"Don't rightly know that either, Your Honor."
"Do you think you've made enough to fill this courtroom?"
"Well, now, let me see. No, no, I don't think I've made enough to fill this room. But I sure made enough to make it slosh around a bit."
An obvious country boy was in court suing a man who had broken into his car and destroyed a lot of the car's interior. The judge said to him,
"Are you suing this man for damages to your car?"
"No, Your Honor. I have all the damages I need. I'm suing him for some repairs."
Troy Toppin, sheriff of Chowan County, had brought a fellow named Joe into court on charges of failure to support three illegitimate children. The plaintiff, Mabel, had testified that she and Joe had lived together for some time, but that Joe had left her and she needed the money to help pay for the three children.
"Were all of your children born out of wedlock?"
"Oh, no, Your Honor. Two of them were born in Martin County."
While we're on the subject of children, soon after the Korean War, a young man had returned from overseas duty and was suing his wife for divorce. It seems she had given birth 18 months after he left for Korea. She was on the stand. The child was born 18 months after your husband left for Korea, right?
That is correct, but he's still the father.
Wait a minute. I want to get this straight. Your husband has been gone for 18 months, and you still claim that he is the father.
That's right.
And could you tell us how that is possible?
Well, you see, he came to me in a dream one night.
In a dream? Do you mean to tell me that you believe you hugged and kissed a ghost?
That's what happened.
I've never heard of such a thing. Has anyone in this court ever had an experience where he kissed a ghost?
Let me guess. Nobody said a thing.
For a while. There was a dead silence in the courtroom for a while. Then one old farmer in his bib overalls slowly raised his hand. You, sir, come up here. Now, do you mean to tell us that you actually kissed a ghost?
A ghost? Oh, no, sir. I didn't hear you quite right. I thought you said a goat.
And that is a true story from Haywood County, North Carolina.
We'll leave the stories for a while. At the heart of our judicial system is the constitutional right of trial by jury.
How did the jury come about?
Well, the position of the jury is a central part of the system of English justice. And as far back in English history as 913, there was a legal code that recognized the norm as 12 good men and true. By the 12th century, that principle was firmly established in English law.
But there is an even earlier tradition involving the number 12 that might be a little surprising. Some scholars have pointed out that this system that emerged in the 12th century under English law is almost identical with Islamic latif.
Well, how did that happen?
Let's just say might have happened, and possibly like this. From the late 9th century, there were Muslim rulers in Sicily.
In 1061, the Normans invaded Sicily. And the Norman conquerors ended up establishing close ties with the Muslim inhabitants.
And then jump forward. The Normans were blood relatives of Henry II, the English king credited with founding English common law.
Whatever the connection, here's a description of the Muslim Latif. It was a body of 12 members drawn from the neighborhood and sworn to tell the truth. They were bound to give a unanimous verdict about the things they had seen or heard regarding any situation brought before them. And that verdict was binding on the judge for the purpose of establishing the truth of any case involving ordinary citizens.
And it was the right of any plaintiff to demand this kind of process. So before its appearance in English law, the Latif is an earlier example of 12 good men and true.
I once heard that for juries, they used to select one person from each of the 12 signs of the zodiac. It was thought they would have 12 different perceptions, and that way they ended up with 12 people on a jury and 12 different points of view.
I've not heard that before, but it is possible.
Anyway, what's important is that any person accused is given the maximum amount of freedom to prove his or her innocence. You can't be convicted just because somebody doesn't like you.
Isn't it possible, then, that someone who is guilty might get away with it?
Yes, that is possible. But we believe in the concept that it is better that a guilty man goes free rather than an innocent one be convicted.
But sometimes even that goes wrong.
True, but that is one of the reasons why a jury selected depends upon seeking to find people who are truly unbiased.
I hadn't thought about that. If someone has made up their mind about something, they're not going to hear facts except to prove what they already believe.
And there is less of a chance of that happening with a jury of ordinary people rather than a panel of people with a predetermined point of view.
Do we have any stories about juries?
Oh, funny you should ask. And we'll start out with jury selection. An insight from Buchanan and Terrell is that some people will do just about anything to get out of jury duty. And there can be a lot of humor in the process.
I'd like to hear some of the excuses that someone might give, thinking that that would get him off the jury.
In his many years as district attorney in Gastonia, Joseph Brown had learned a few things about jury selection. One might be called, when you least expect it, at least in terms of excuses invented. One such memorable incident occurred during the selection of a jury for a defendant charged with assault on a female. Mr. Brown asked the prospective jurors if any of them had ever been charged for assault on a female. Reluctantly, three male members of the jury pool raised their hands. Brown immediately dismissed all three of them. As he watched the proceedings, another man raised his hand and asked to speak to the district attorney. Mr. Brown called the man over and asked, "Have you ever been charged with assault on a female?"
"No, sir. I've never laid a hand on my wife. But if you excuse me from these proceedings, I promise to go home and whip her as soon as I get there."
One murder case Mr. Brown was prosecuting had received a lot of press and media coverage, and the district attorney wanted to be sure that this publicity didn't unduly affect the prospective jurors. One by one, he asked them,
"Have you read about the case in the newspapers or heard about it on television? Have you formed or expressed an opinion based on what you have read or heard?"
Each person so questioned answered dutifully that they had neither heard about the case nor formed an opinion. But when got to the sixth man and again repeated the question, the man replied,
"No, sir. I have not seen or read anything, but my wife has. And if you'd like, I'll be glad to tell you what she thinks."
A standard question asked of jury pools is if any of the attorneys or the judge has ever appeared in a case in which any member of the jury had an interest. When Grady Stott from Gastonia asked that question, one man raised his hand.
"Mr. Stott, you represented my wife in our divorce case."
"Then, sir, did I do anything during the course of that trial which might prejudice you in the case we are about to try?"
"Oh, no, sir, nothing at all. You did just fine. You lost the case."
In another case, the question was asked, "Is there any reason why you cannot form an impartial decision?"
"Well, there might be."
"Will you explain that answer?"
"Well, juror number 12 is my ex-wife, and from past experience I can guarantee you that we will not be able to agree on anything."
"Are you a property holder?"
"Yes, I am."
"Married or single?"
"Married for 20 years.
"Have you formed and expressed an opinion?"
"Not in 20 years.
A prospective juror in a Dallas court was surprised by the definition that was given of voluntary manslaughter. Here is what she heard.
"An intentional killing that occurs while the defendant is under the immediate influence of a sudden passion arousing from an adequate cause, such as when a spouse's mate is found in a compromising position."
Does anyone have a problem with that explanation?
Sir, I'm a little unclear with that passion business.
What's the problem?
During my first marriage, I came home one day and found my husband in bed with one of my neighbors.
That's exactly the kind of situation to which I was referring. What's the problem?
All I did was divorce him. I didn't know that I could have shot him.
I wonder if those excuses worked for any of the would-be jurors.
I don't know the answer to that, but if none of those cases might apply to you, here are some suggestions that are guaranteed to get you dismissed.
Paste a tattoo on your arm that says, "Hang 'em high."
When being questioned by attorneys, don't answer without flipping a coin.
Wear a hangman's noose for a necktie.
Bring the prosecutor a cake that says, "Happy birthday, Uncle Harry."
Insist on being sworn in on a copy of Batman Comics.
Tell them you have to leave early each day to get back to the halfway house.
If any of those suggestions don't get you off the jury, they might at least earn you a citation for contempt of court.
I have one last thought on trying to get off a jury.
Is this one guaranteed to get me off?
Well, listen, and then you decide. The person on trial is you.
Well, I want the best jury I can get.
But everyone wants to get off. They have better things to do, and no one cares enough to listen to the facts in your situation to make a decision. What do you think?
But I need them.
And someone else may need you.
While Bob's thinking about that, when we are talking about the difference in achieving a just decision in court between a jury of ordinary people and a biased panel, I thought of an example we might share to demonstrate this.
What's the example, Para?
From the late 19th century in France, the Dreyfus Affair.
I remember hearing about this back in school. The guy was incorrectly accused of something, I don't quite remember what, But the mistake was corrected, and that ended the affair.
That's all you remember?
Yeah. So what's the point in using it as an example of the importance of an unbiased jury?
You just might have been sleeping through that lecture. There's a lot more to that story than that. It all started out with someone digging through the trash at the German War Office. When they discovered a group of handwritten documents that made it clear that someone in the French military was providing the Germans with French military secrets.
This is a great example, Para. You would think, with this discovery, an attempt would be made to discover who was responsible.
But what if that might indicate somebody in your group, in this case, someone in the French military, and it's the French military that is doing the investigating?
Right. So instead of trying to find out who is responsible, what if we just try to find someone to blame?
Well, that's not fair.
But effective.
At that time, the French war ministry was very conservative and highly anti-Semitic.
So, who can we blame? Look, there's a guy who might have had access to the secrets.
Notice she said, might have.
And he certainly fits the bill. He happens to be Jewish, and he came from Alsace, a former French possession that had been annexed by the Germans in 1871. What a great person to blame.
Alfred Dreyfus, obviously guilty.
But what about evidence?
They had the handwritten notes found in the garbage.
But had Dreyfus written them?
Picky, picky, picky.
He didn't.
When you have the ideal person to blame, don't sweat the small stuff.
And so he was convicted?
Arrested on October 15th, 1894, and found guilty on December 22nd of the same year.
They didn't waste much time, did they?
And it's off to Devil's Island with you, life imprisonment.
By the way, there really was such a place as Devil's Island. It was France's penal colony, located just off the coast of French Guiana in South America.
But what about his being freed? That's what they taught me.
When you have someone to blame, why try to get him freed?
Oh, come on, guys.
Okay. Eventually, he did get freed, but it took some doing. The first thing to be noticed was that even though Alfred Dreyfus was now in prison, halfway around the world, military secrets were still appearing in the hands of the Germans.
2 years had now passed by. You mustn't rush things, and Lieutenant Colonel Jorge Picard became head of the counterintelligence department. Now, he was an anti-Semite himself.
So not particularly inclined towards Dreyfus.
But even he could plainly see that the handwriting in the papers used to convict Dreyfus was not his, and it didn't take much to discover to whom the handwriting did belong. One Major Ferdinand Esterhazy.
So, Dreyfus is freed, right?
Well, not so fast. We must follow procedures.
Okay. They had to make sure that Esterhazy was the man responsible.
What they found out was that Esterhazy had, in the past, misrepresented himself as royalty, and had run off to join the Foreign Legion before joining the French regulars.
Anything in his favor?
Oh, a big anything. He wasn't Jewish.
Back to Esterhazy. It seems that the poor man had gotten himself into grave financial difficulties and been forced to sell French military secrets in order to get out of debt.
Picard was not all sympathetic to Esterhazy's financial predicament, and he had Esterhazy court-martialed in 1897.
Now Dreyfus is freed.
Au contraire, mon frère. Esterhazy was acquitted by his fellow officers.
And Picard, for his pains, was eventually arrested and thrown into jail.
So he was never free?
Don't get ahead of the story. While some were content to have someone to blame, others were not. Now, to the front of the affair comes one Émile Zola, the novelist. He wrote a piece called J'accuse, that is, I accuse.
In it, he accused the French military of knowing that Dreyfus was innocent and covering it up.
Did that get some reaction?
Oh, indeed it did. There was a split throughout the French society over the issue. The intellectuals were on one side, and the military and the church were on the other. Anti-Semitic riots broke out across the country, and Zola was tried for libel, and he was convicted. He had to flee the country.
If you thought things couldn't get more exciting, just wait. One Major Hubert Joseph Henry, who was the man who discovered the infamous papers in the beginning, was found to have planted the papers to incriminate Dreyfus.
Henry admitted that they were forgeries, and he committed suicide in 1899. Meanwhile, Esther Hazy suddenly remembered, late one evening, that he had important business in Belgium. When people came looking for him, they found that he had skipped town.
Well, you can't just ignore important business in Belgium. What next?
A new government took power in France and brought Dreyfus back from Devil's Island and granted him a new trial, at which time all this new evidence was presented. The stories concerning Henry and Esther Hazy, the forgeries, and the mixed-up handwriting.
Finally, they found him innocent.
Remember we told you earlier, not so fast? Sorry, still too fast. They again found him guilty.
What?
Remember, it was still the military running the court-martial. They know who to blame.
So he was sent back to prison?
No, at this point, the French president stepped in and issued a pardon. Dreyfus accepted it on the condition that he could continue to press for an official verdict of innocence.
Did he finally get it?
Yes, from a civilian court who cleared him of all wrongdoing and reversed his previous convictions. This was in 1906, some 12 years after the whole affair started.
And that's the end of the story. Justice finally prevails.
Well, hold that thought until you hear the rest of the story.
There's more?
Just a little. Remember that at the beginning, the military wasn't looking for who was responsible. They were looking for someone to blame.
Okay, what else happened?
Alfred Dreyfus was reinstated in the army in July of 1906 and was awarded the Legion of Honor.
Esther Hazy, who finally admitted that he was a German spy, moved to England where he worked as a translator and writer.
Picquart, after spending some time in jail, returned to the army and was promoted to general in 1906 after Esther Hazy's guilt was established.
Emile Zola died in 1902, asphyxiated by a chimney fire which some claim was caused by people opposed to Dreyfus.
In 1908, Zola's remains were interred in the Pantheon. At the ceremony, a right-wing journalist tried to assassinate Dreyfus, but only slightly wounded him.
The journalist was later put on trial for the attempted murder of Dreyfus, but was acquitted.
The image of the French military, the church, and the anti-Semitic movement had been deeply damaged over the affair, and they finally got around to admitting that Dreyfus was, well, you know.
Innocent?
At least not to blame. They did this in 1995.
No, you mean 1905.
No, 1995. And this was only after an official historical journal not so subtly suggested that the military still thought Dreyfus was guilty.
Mistakes can happen. But I see your point about unbiased juries better serving the case of justice than official panels.
And?
And I think I might have a different look at serving on a jury, if I'm called.
Good for you. And if you are called, here are some stories that might serve as examples of things that have happened in a courtroom and might happen again.
You mean these are situations where the truth of the matter lies in the fact that lightning may strike twice in the same place. And if I happen to be there, then what may be true or not true, according to the attorneys present and what they present, may or may not be stranger than fiction, or nonfiction, or not.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Kurt, don't you think we ought to have gotten a writ of habeas corpus for him?
Correct grammar, please, Para. Present tense is writ of habeas corpus. Past tense, which you used here, is written of habeas corpus.
Para, don't ask.
Don't worry. And even if I did, who would I tell?
Whom? Now, what are some of the things that I might need to know if I end up in court?
To answer that, we can look at some more true cases, not just from North Carolina, but from all over the country. These are courtesy of another book, also entitled Disorder in the Court, and written by Charles Sevilla.
A case from Dardanelle, Arkansas. I object, Your Honor. What I want to make perfectly clear is that there is a time when the truth has to stop.
And why is that?
Because the trial has started.
From Chicago, Illinois. Your Honor, I would object to the defense counsel's characterization of this disagreement. It is entirely one-sided.
What do you expect of a trial attorney?
From Joshua Tree, California. Sir, you mumbled on the first part of that, and I couldn't understand what you were saying. Could you repeat the question?
I mumbled, did I? Well, let's just ask the court reporter to read back what I said. She didn't indicate any problem understanding what I said, so, obviously, she understood every word. We'll just have her read my question back and find out if there was any mumbling going on. Madam Reporter, would you be so kind?
From Richmond, Virginia, Your Honor, the defense would argue the people haven't proved the prior conviction.
Oh, pussy feathers.
Is that a legal term?
One used quite often in law school.
From Portland, Oregon, in the course of your years practicing as an attorney, did you have any problems with alcohol from time to time?
Yes.
Objection. Move to strike.
On what grounds?
It's irrelevant, and I might define for the court, since I think that there are going to be a substantial number of these questions, that it's the state's position that an attorney who has an IQ of 41, who has barely passed the bar, and who has fouled up every other case that they have ever tried is perfectly capable of giving adequate legal services within the meaning of the Constitution.
From Los Angeles, California, although the defense counsel admits fault in not filing the written notice of motion, he points out that the fault is not all his own. It was because he was delayed, missed his client in Riverside, and was arrested and charged as a felon in Chino, resulting in stress and the failure to file the motion papers herein demanded by the people.
From Houston, Texas, Counsel, I'm going to ask you that unless you have a throat lozenge, that you not eat candy in the courtroom.
I have Rolaids.
Rolaids?
Consumes 47 times his weight in stomach acid, and I have stomach acid.
You create some stomach acid on the part of the court.
I have two left.
From Valdosta, Georgia, I'm perfecting the record because it is my position that the court incorrectly instructed the jury.
You show me authority to that effect.
That presumption means that the defendant is, in fact, innocent as he sits there.
That's an impossibility for anyone to believe that. If he were innocent, he wouldn't be sitting there. There would be no need for a trial.
From Charleston, South Carolina, if that is your verdict, so say you all.
You all.
From Sacramento, California, do you remember the context in which your husband brought the issue up?
Not really. I tried not listening when he talks.
From Sacramento, California, how do you know that these teeth came from a dead man, by the way?
How do I know that the teeth I examined came from a dead man?
Yes.
Because they weren't moving.
From Bedford, Maine, what about the research?
I don't think there is any research on that. There's a logical hunch that may be true, but I know of no research study that would support that at this time.
What about just common sense?
Well, I'm not here using common sense. I'm here as an expert.
Doctor, you testified that the deceased was shot in the chest by a 12-gauge shotgun at a distance of not more than 3 feet.
Yes.
And this is the cause of his immediate death? That's correct?
Yes.
Now, doctor, which way would someone fall after receiving a 12-gauge shotgun blast directly in the chest from a distance of 3 feet or less?
Down.
From Phoenix, Arizona, we're not arguing truth here. We're arguing evidence.
From Baraboo, Wisconsin, is Exhibit Number 2 a picture?
Yes.
And who is it a picture of?
Me.
Can you tell me what you see, or what is Exhibit Number 2?
It's a cut to the side of the throat.
Okay, but before we get to that point, what is this?
Me.
That's not you in person, is it?
Yes.
And were you present when this picture was taken?
And finally, from Fresno, California, a police officer was being questioned about a vehicle he had examined and was asked if he had found anything.
Yes, I did. When I found the vehicle, I found several unusual items on the right floorboard of the vehicle. There was what appeared to be a Molotov cocktail, a green bottle...
Objection! I'm going to object to that word, Molotov cocktail.
What is your objection, counsel?
It's inflammatory, Your Honor.
We have a few other North Carolina stories, not in the courtroom, but about the people who are in the court for their livelihood. One of Western Carolina's most prominent trial lawyers...
Who shall remain nameless.
...and his secretary...
With whom he always maintained the utmost decorum.
...had to fly to Kansas City. When they landed, they went directly to the hotel.
At which the secretary had made the most proper arrangements.
But when they arrived, they found that the arrangements had all gone haywire.
In other words, they didn't have adjoining rooms.
Gaflugity.
They didn't even have separate rooms.
South for the winter.
The best the hotel had left was one room in which they offered to hang a blanket between the beds for privacy.
Though they complained, there was nothing else they could do.
So they decided to make the best of a bad situation.
Things went well until sometime during the early hours a cold breeze came blowing through the window and the secretary was chilled.
Are you awake?
Yeah.
It's getting awfully cold in here with that window open. Would you get up and close the window, please?
As an alternative, how would you like to be my wife tonight?
Oh, I think that would be quite nice.
Good. You get up and close the window.
Like I said, the lawyer shall remain nameless.
In the 1930s, Lyndon McKee was known and admired by most of the folks in Jackson County. He had a live-in valet and chauffeur who occasionally took a weekend off. Before one such outing, Mr. McKee gave him a half-gallon of corn squeezins. When the chauffeur returned the following Monday morning, he was a little worse for wear. So Mr. McKee asked,
"How was the whiskey?"
Whiskey was just right, sir.
What do you mean, just right?
Well, if the whiskey was any better, you wouldn't have given it to me. If it were any worse, I couldn't have drunk it.
Around 1976, a certain judge held a special session of Jackson County Superior Court.
You know, there seems to be a lot of these unnamed lawyers and judges around. Think it might have something to do with the corn squeezins?
Mind your manners, because this particular judge brought his young wife along with him to enjoy the beautiful surroundings.
And the wife, being quite attractive herself, fit right in.
And this judge made it quite clear that he appreciated all aspects of his wife. During the course of the evening, he announced to some friends,
"I have a beautiful wife. She's young, very romantic, and has a brother who owns a liquor store in South Carolina. Now, who could ask for anything more from just one woman?" Attorney Buck Talman woke up one morning and found his backyard flooded. He was due in court, so he quickly called a plumber who promised to send two men over immediately. The last thing he told the plumber was,
"Tell them to dig up those pipes and fix them. This place is beginning to look like Lake James."
When he arrived back home later that day, there were the plumbers, there were lots of holes, and they looking more like Lake James all the time.
"What's going on?"
"Can't seem to find the leaky pipes, but we'll keep at it until we do."
About that time, the next generation Talman appears and asks, "What's happening, Daddy?"
"We've got water coming from somewhere, and they're digging holes trying to find the leaky pipes."
Somewhat sheepishly, the youngest Talman walked over to a pile of pine needles and pulled up a hose with a steady stream of water issuing forth. "Here, Daddy, I used to fill up my wading pool yesterday, and I didn't know how to turn it off."
"We'll send you the bill."
Dr. H.F. Cotton Robinson, Chancellor of Western Carolina University, sought counsel in defense of a suit filed against the university during his tenure and settled upon Asheville attorney Herbert L. Hyde, an alumnus of the university. In the courtroom, Hyde matched wits and evidence against two attorneys representing the other side. At the end of the first day of testimony, Dr. Robinson asked Hyde to dinner, and their conversation naturally got around to the trial.
"Well, how do you think we're doing?"
"Oh, we're doing all right. I think we did just fine today."
"Well, tomorrow, I'd like you to have help. Bring another lawyer."
"Another lawyer? Why? We did just fine today."
"Well, maybe."
"All right, out with it. What's bothering you?"
"Well, as I was sitting there watching today, I had a thought that we could have done better."
"And how do you figure that?"
"Well, I noticed how those two lawyers on the other side worked together."
"And?"
"Well, it seemed to me that while one of them was standing up talking, the other one was sitting there thinking."
"Yes."
"And while you were standing up there talking, we didn't have anyone thinking for us."
Superior Court Judge Henry Grady was one of the most distinguished-looking jurists and held court well into his 80s. One time he was assigned to a court in Pittsburgh, but he had overslept. He was speeding towards the court, only he was driving his wife's car, which didn't carry judicial plates.
Suddenly he looked in his rearview mirror and saw flashing red lights. Now, what to do? Applying all of his jurisprudential acuity...
His what?
That's lawyer talk for thinking fast.
Did he also apply his solicitorial glossolalia?
Isn't it illegal in some parts of North Carolina?
Luckily, we're not in that area. Well, he jumped out of his car before the officer could tell him to roll down his window, and he said,
"Young man, do you happen to know who I am? I'm Judge Henry Grady, and I've been observing your driving habits for the last 3 or 4 miles. Recklessness, if I've ever seen it. You follow me to the courthouse and radio your sergeant to meet us there while we talk about your driving."
And with that, he trotted back to his car, jumped in, and drove off. When he arrived, he pulled into a parking place. The officer pulled in next to him. The judge got out of the car and walked up to the police vehicle.
"Young man, I want you to know that your driving has improved 1,000% since we last talked. Cancel the call to your sergeant and just forget about this incident."
"Well, thank you, Your Honor, and allow me to help you carry your bags upstairs."
Was that an example of constabular obsequiousness?
Wait a minute. I know that's got to be illegal.
Bob, just look it up when you get home tonight.
Look, Bob, here comes the judge. And the judge in question was William Z. Wood from Haywood County. Now, this story is not about him, but it was one of his favorite stories, and he claimed that it was true.
Oh, I just love true stories.
We know.
Whether they really happened or not.
Now, a mule is a mighty peculiar critter. You ever watched one up close? You notice that he won't go inside anywhere when his ears might touch a doorway. Now, when young Bill was just a tad, his pappy owned a mule, and that was the bestest mule you could ever find. Except for one except. He had the shortest ears of any mule you'd ever seen.
So when Bill's pappy built a shed for the mule to keep it out of the rain and bad weather, he carefully measured the height of the mule's ears and made the doorway just a mite taller, but in a fine 24-inch log to mark the spot.
However, he didn't put any flooring in since he figured he hadn't built a floor for himself. Why should he build one for the mule? Makes sense to me.
Well, wouldn't you know it? One morning, Pappy went out to fetch the mule to start the day's plowing, and there, inside the shed, lay the mule.
Rolled over on one side.
Legs up in the air.
Passed on.
Pushing up daisies.
Pining for the fjords.
I didn't know he was that kind of mule.
Explains the short ears.
Anyway, after a day of burying, Pappy went out looking for another mule.
Found one.
Pretty as you please.
Had nice big mule ears.
Which didn't register on Pappy.
So when Pappy got the mule home, he tried to put him in that shed and...
ears touched.
Rubbed against that 24-inch log.
Mule wouldn't move an inch.
Well, Pappy surveyed the situation and took some measurements.
Measured the mule.
Measured the ears.
Had to know how much clearance he needed to get the mule to pass under.
Then he went out and got a hammer and a chisel and started to notch some grooves in that fine oak log.
Deep enough to let the ears pass on through.
Terrible thing to do to a fine 24-inch oak log.
But a man's got to do what a man's got to do.
While Bill's paw is chiseling away, Bill's ma is watching, and she finally speaks up.
Instead of spoiling that fine 24-inch oak log, why don't you just take a shovel and dig the dirt down a bit?
Dagnabbit, woman, ain't you got no sense at all? It's as plain as the nose on your face. It's the ears that are too long, not the legs.
And all that really happened right here in North Carolina.
Just by applying some laws of physics and some laws of common sense.
Speaking of laws and getting back to the courtroom, we might look at one of the earliest codes of law written down in history. That code is attributed to Hammurabi of Babylon. In about 1780 BCE, he had his favorite 282 laws carved into an 8-foot-high stone column.
Obviously, no one in town could claim they didn't know that something was against the law.
Remember the great line from the novel Animal Farm? All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Not only could people in Babylon not claim they didn't know the law, they also couldn't claim that the law treated everyone the same.
That reminds me of a saying from an Italian jurist of the mid-18th century, Cesare Beccaria. He said, "The majority of all laws are nothing but privileges, that is, a tribute paid by all to the convenience of some few."
Under Hammurabi, the higher up the social ladder you were, the less severely you were punished. And depending upon whom the crime was committed, the punishment changed.
For instance, if someone stole a goat from the temple, the fine was 30 times the price of the goat. If it was from a free man, the fine was 10 times.
And if the person couldn't afford to pay?
The Queen of Hearts took charge.
The Queen of Hearts?
Yes. Off with his head. Death penalty.
Were there a lot of crimes punishable by death?
Accusing someone of a crime without proof.
Falsely accusing someone of a crime.
Stealing the property of a temple or court.
Receiving stolen property of a temple or court.
Stealing a slave.
Helping a slave escape.
Hiding a slave.
Breaking and entering.
Committing a robbery.
Allowing conspirators to meet in your tavern.
Violating a virgin who is promised in marriage to another.
And some crimes call for extreme measures.
Killing you isn't extreme?
Not extreme enough. If a wife and her lover have their mates murdered, both shall be impaled.
If a robbery is committed during a fire, the criminal will be thrown in the self-same fire.
If you're a priestess and you own or enter a tavern, you'll be burned to death.
What about not so extreme?
Okay. How about just getting your hands cut off?
That could happen if you were a surgeon and someone died during the operation.
Also, if you stole corn or plants from a farmer you worked for.
Or if you hit your father.
And if you were a slave and told your master, "You are not my master," they would cut your ear off.
Wow. They probably didn't have much crime back in Babylon.
I don't know. You don't carve 282 laws on a stone column in the middle of the city without reason.
Maybe they served as an incentive.
How's that?
Well, if you attained a higher position, you weren't punished as severely. So don't worry about your present condition. Plan for when you can move up on the social ladder and be privileged yourself.
Earlier, Bob quoted a saying from Cesar Beccaria. He had some very interesting ideas. In a work called On Crime and Punishment, he stated that every act of authority of one man over another, for which there is not an absolute necessity, is tyrannical.
And he understood justice to mean nothing more than the bond which is necessary to keep the interests of individuals united. Without that bond, men would return to their natural state of barbarity.
And all punishments which exceeded the necessity of preserving that bond are in their nature unjust.
Not only was he opposed to the death penalty, he also believed that punishment had a preventative, not a retributive faction, that it should be proportionate to the crime committed, that the certainty of punishment, not its severity, would achieve the preventative effect, that procedures of criminal convictions should be public, and that in order to be effective, punishment should be prompt.
There are sure some things there that merit consideration.
Yeah. It sounds like we haven't made up our minds if the purpose of the justice system is to rehabilitate or punish.
Good point.
How about getting back to some more North Carolina stories?
Robert McMillan had earned a reputation of being an outstanding criminal defense lawyer. Just after he was assigned to represent a defendant confined in the Wake County Jail, the defendant made a dramatic escape from the fifth floor of the prison. He was apprehended later, and when asked why he had tried to escape, he answered,
"I just don't like them inexperienced lawyers in the indigent defense program. I broke out so I could go out and find a good lawyer."
Up in Nash County, Judge Bartholomew was noted for his brevity above all else. One spring night, the judge was rousted from his sleep by the incessant rattle of pebbles against his bedroom window. He rose from his bed like a hound from hell, ready to proclaim the perpetrator in compos mentis.
That's a legal description for a six-ply, puncture-proof idiot.
When the judge looked down, he saw a buggy on his front lawn with a young couple that he knew well. Before he could say a word, the young man yelled,
"Judge, either marry us quick or be a witness to murder. Her pappy is a-coming with a shotgun, and I only got a 2-minute head start."
The judge yelled, "Hitched, not get going."
And that holds the Nash County, Eastern Carolina, and the Baptist World Alliance record for the shortest wedding ceremony ever performed.
Dr. John T. Bunn had been the pastor of the First Baptist Church up in Silva, the hometown of Buck Buchanan. One time, the Reverend Doctor was requested to appear as a character witness for a trial in Lilith over the Harnett County. This was a case in which the defendant actually had some character to witness to. As he sat in the witness chair, the prosecutor took over, and everyone knew what his purpose was going to be. It wasn't to praise the character of the defendant.
Now, Dr. Bunn, You are a minister, are you not?
That I am. Pastor of the First Baptist Church in Silva.
And as such, you are required by your profession to find a little good in everyone. Now, is that not true?
Yes, sir. I guess I have to plead guilty as charged to that statement.
The worst person, the guiltiest person, even a reprobate, you'd find some good, correct?
You better believe it. If I looked hard enough, I could even find some good in an attorney.
One of the, what I would call, regular customers of the Hartford County Jail was serving a sentence in the capacity of trustee during the session of Superior Court. Now, the jail was directly adjacent to the courtroom, and Sheriff James E. Baker liked to keep a fresh pitcher of ice water on the bench for the presiding judge. So just before the morning session began, the sheriff spoke to the trustee.
I want you to go into the courtroom and get the judge's pitcher.
Yes, sir.
When the sheriff returned a few minutes later, he found that a large and very expensive portrait had been taken from the wall behind the judge's bench and was now lying on his desk.
What in the world are you doing with this painting?
Well, you told me to get the judge's picture. It's the only one I could find.
At the time that Buck Buchanan was a 30th District solicitor, he filed for re-election and was told that a young lawyer from one of the smaller counties was nosing and asking about possibility of running against old Buck. He decided to have a talk with Blaine Stolcutt, the high sheriff of old Cherokee County.
Howdy, Sheriff. I'm thinking of running for solicitor here, and I just wanted to introduce myself.
Nice to meet you.
I know I'd be new to the area, but I'm hard-working and honest. And with you knowing all the goings-on around here, I was just wondering what you thought of my chances might be.
Well, let's see. Are you married?
Yes, I am, but what difference would that make?
Well, if you and your wife moved down here local soon and got properly registered to vote, I figured you could count on maybe two votes. Story is told of a couple of men passing through a graveyard one evening when they came upon a tombstone that read, "Here lies a lawyer and a Christian gentleman," at which one of the men commented,
"There's plenty of room in this cemetery. I wonder why they buried them both in the same grave." Many stories are told of R. Greg Cherry, who grew up in Gastonia. During his career, he served as mayor of Gastonia, in the House and in the Senate, and served as governor from 1945 to 1949.
One famous comment made about him was that he was the best lawyer in Gastonia when he was sober, and the second best lawyer when he was drunk.
He was also known for his quick wit and biting humor, demonstrated in a couple of stories following.
When a member of the Highway Commission died, an eager young politician approached the governor at graveside during the funeral and whispered,
"Governor, I'd sure like to take the old commissioner's place."
"Well, it's all right with me if it's all right with the undertaker."
An angry voter once cornered him at the gathering and told him, "I wouldn't vote for you if you were the Archangel Gabriel."
"Well then, madam, your problem is solved. If I were the Archangel Gabriel, you couldn't vote in my precinct."
Once during a long and tiresome reception at the Executive Mansion, there was one man who was delaying the receiving line by standing in front of the governor and repeating, "You don't know my name, do you?" He solved the delay by thrusting the man's hand into that of William B. Umstead, who was standing next to him in line, and saying,
"William, tell this damn fool his name."
And finally, Cherry once appealed a guilty verdict against one of his clients to the state's Supreme Court. On the day of the argument, the Chief Justice said, "Governor, we're all pleased to have you with us in Raleigh again."
"Well, if it pleased the court, I'm just here to ask you to correct a bad mistake in the Superior Court and send this case back for a new trial."
"Governor, we have read the record and the briefs, and we intend to do just that."
"I'm obliged to you. I believe that I will bring you gentlemen some more of my business."
A mightily strange book came out in 1947 under the lofty auspices of Stevens & Sons Limited of London. Though it might have sold well amidst Halsbury's and Blackstone, this one had the anomaly of being somewhat anonymous, being authored by a mysterious JPC. But the title was brilliant and hopefully not trademark, as it carried the same name of a poetic justice hallmark. It began with the alphabet, only this one is for lawyers. A is for arson, the firing of houses. B is for bigamy. Too many spouses. C is for caveat. Emptor, beware. D is for defense, which are counsel, prepare. E is for extraditions of chaps from abroad. F is for felony, forgery, fraud. G is for all the goodwill you will need. H is for heir, who will try to succeed. I is for identity, plus the parade. J is for juries, who never get paid. K is for kin, who are sought from afar. L is for lawyers, all sides of the bar. M is for mandamus, for which we have waited. N is for nuisance, as yet unabated. O is for oath, on the old or the new. P is for paperwork, long overdue. Q is for question, which counsel will ask? R is the refresher he needs for his task. S is for sacrilege, stealing from churches. T is for title, a good one on purchase. U is for usage, the custom of trade. V is for view, which his lordship has made. W is for wife, and for woolsack, and wills. X is the sum of solicitor's bills. Y is the number of years you will get. And Z is a crime we do not know of yet.
Some final thoughts. If we desire respect for the law, we must first make the law respectable.
It is better to prevent crimes than to punish them.
The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is an attribute of the strong.
This is Kirk Benry for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And thanks for listening to this edition of Did You Know?
This is Farah Tolson. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is generously supported by WRIL.com, a part of the Capital Broadcasting Company's new media group.
And this is Bob Martin. Did You Know airs each Thursday at 9 p.m. with encore presentations Saturday at noon and Sunday evening at 8. It is also available by podcast by going to the Triangle Radio Reading website and clicking on the podcast section on the right-hand navigation bar.
If you would be able to help underwrite any of the special programming of TRRS, please call us at 919-832-5138. We continue on the air only through your generosity.
That's 919-832-5138. Any help you could offer will be rewarded by time off for good behavior by any judge mentioned in today's show.
Paula, you can't say that.
Why not?
Because you need the court's permission first.
And if any judge knew you...
I object.
Maybe we'll have to have this case resolved by next week.
So until then, goodbye.